Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, it's my great pleasure to announce Larry Lessig. Larry Lessig was here at the Wizards of Oz 3 to launch the German versions of the Creative Commons licenses. He's here today to give a keynote at Wizards of Oz 4. And there is another special surprise, but that's for after the talk. Please, Larry Lessig.
So I've been spending a long, long time trying to talk about the distinction between what I call read-only and read-write culture. This was a distinction suggested to me by a story that Tim Wu tells in an article he published in Virginia Law Review. The story goes something like this. In 1906, this man, really terrible composer, John Philip Sousa, went to this place, the United States Capitol, to talk about this technology, what Sousa referred to as the talking machines. Sousa was not a fan of the talking machines. This is what he had to say. These talking machines are going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country. When I was a boy in front of every house in the summer evenings, you would find young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. Today you hear these infernal machines going night and day. We will not have a vocal cord left, Sousa said. The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape. Now, this is the picture I want you to focus on. I want you to think about this image of young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. This is a picture of culture. We could call it, using modern computer terminology, a read-write culture. It's a culture in which people participate in the creation and the recreation of their culture. In that sense, it's read-write. And Sousa's fear was that the capacity for the millions across society to practice this read-write culture would be lost because of these, quote, infernal machines. These machines would take it away, displace it, and in its place, we would have the opposite of a read-write culture, what we could call a read-only culture. Read-only culture in the sense that there's creativity that's consumed, but the consumer is not a creator. Culture which is in that sense top-down, where the vocal cords of the millions in this peer-to-peer way would be lost. Now, it's pretty hard when you look back at the 20th century, at least in what we call the developed world, pretty hard not to conclude that Sousa was right. Never before in the history of human culture had his production been as concentrated, never before as professionalized, never before had creativity of the many been as effectively displaced and displaced by these, quote, infernal machines. 20th century was that century, especially in my country, where this read-write capacity disappeared, and in its place, the simple read-only culture. Now, as I've been telling this story about culture, it struck me that this is actually not a story just about culture. Instead, it's a much more general story. General in the sense that more than culture has experienced exactly the same transition. So think about culture around work. In the United States in the 19th century, the Republican Party was born on a platform that spoke of free labor, free speech, free territory. Now focus on free labor. No one was confused in this platform about whether by free labor they meant laborers worked for free. That was not an issue. What they were focusing on was an idea, the integrity of what it meant to be someone working, what labor meant. So Steinfeld describes it first as an idea that labor undertaken under rules that did not give employers either the right to invoke criminal penalties for the departure or the right to specific performance, because in the 18th and 17th century, it was extremely rare that the employee had the right to leave his employment. In the 18th century is littered with statutes that make it a crime for the employee to break a labor contract. Now, slowly, this idea of controlling labor is erased. And in our tradition, the 13th Amendment, which sounds to be about slavery, was actually an amendment that banned a much more fundamental idea, the idea that the worker loses his autonomy simply by being a worker. So the main tenet of the Republican ideology from Tom Paine to Thomas Jefferson to Lincoln was that freedom entailed the ownership of productive property and the rejection of what we would think of as wage labor. The late part of the 19th century, New Republic ran this editorial: when a man agrees to sell his labor, he agrees by implication to surrender his political and social independence. Widespread diffusion of ownership of productive property was essential to a virtuous, independent, self-reliant, frugal, and intelligent citizenry and a nation's liberty. Now, this ideal of the free labor movement was stillborn immediately after it captured America's political landscape. After the Civil War, those who defended free labor thought they had won. But instead, industrialization through the United States and around the world increasingly sapped away the possibility of free labor. By 1870, 70% of people were working for wages, not in this free labor way. And so though there was a technical possibility of continuing this ideal, there was a tension with the technology. Now, that tension in the 19th century, by the 20th century, was totally wiped out. Free labor as an ideal was killed, and it was killed by these massive centralized conceptions of control over work and production. Free labor in this century became a fantasy, something no one even today, I think, really remembers as an ideal of what it would mean to be a worker. But of course, what's amazing about the 21st century is that this conception of ownership, of one's own ability to work, is being revived. This is the story Yochai tells in his book, Eric von Hippel in Democratizing Innovation, Stephen Weber in The Success of Open Source. It's what the GNU Linux project has demonstrated. It's what happens in Wikipedia. These are all examples of, you could call them peer-to-peer production or peer production or amateur production, or as Yochai calls them, social production. In all of these cases, what we're seeing is what we could describe in the same sense of read-write culture as read-write work. Once again, imagining the idea that workers do something more than simply take orders and obey a structure they don't control. Same cycle is happening in the context of commerce. 19th century ideas of commerce were decentralized, working, petty bourgeois ideas about how commerce would happen. That gets wiped out in the 20th century by this conception of commerce, centralized, department store. And that gets wiped out by the 21st century of commerce. Ideas like this, eBay, which once again transformed the way in which commerce happens, or maybe most important in the context of politics. 19th century in the United States, the founding moment of movement of the United States government, a party that founded our government, was referred to as the Federalists. They were basically elitists, and they were killed off by an extraordinarily important popular participatory democracy that was first started by the first Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson, then the Democrats of Jackson and Van Buren. These people gave birth to party politics, and that meant that people went out into the world and produced politics. They didn't sit there listening to the elites tell them what they should do, but instead they were participatory in the production of politics. 20th century, once again, has killed this idea of politics. We move to the broadcast politics model, or the cadre politics model, where the idea of politics is just sitting and listening to orders or commands given from central political parties. God forbid that you would actually speak in the context of that type of politics. But here again, 21st century has revived this earlier idea. Joe Trippi and the Dean campaign first made it seem possible, but it's the explosion of politics around blogs, which are active, participatory ways in which politics has recaptured the imagination of a much wider range of the public, read-write politics. Now, the point to see is that when you add together all of these different areas of social life, work, commerce, culture, and politics, there's a very funny pattern that happens in the 20th century. We move from a read-write culture to a read-only culture, and back to a read-write culture as we move into the 21st century, or at least that's the possibility. Now, focused on the one that I've been obsessed about, read-write culture, or what I have talked about in other contexts is the free culture movement. This is a movement that's been enabled by a technology. The technology is the internet. The internet is making possible the idea of reviving this way that culture might be made. Now, of course, there's not just one culture that's being produced by this network. It's not just the read-write culture. Instead, there are two new cultures being produced in this network. These cultures are both a new read-only and a new read-write culture. So the read-only culture that's being produced by the internet is this massively efficient technology to enable people to buy and consume culture produced anywhere. So anytime, at any place, people would have the capacity, according to this ideal of the read-only internet, to consume culture created elsewhere. This is the poster child for this conception of culture. The Apple Corporation, their iTunes music store for 99 cents, allowing you to buy whatever song you want and download it onto your iPod and only your iPod. But you're guaranteed, at least in the United States, to be cool if you engage in this form of commercial and exchange. And it's not just music. Increasingly, videos are being circulated and distributed in exactly the same way. And it's not just Apple. Others too. Amazon experimenting with pay-per-page ways of selling books. Ebook companies experimenting with pay-per-read ways of selling books. In all of these contexts, the objective is to increasingly perfect the control that content owners have over how people consume their, end quote, culture. This is the read-only internet enabled by the technology of the digital network. But at the same time, there's an emerging read-write internet. This is the network being supported by companies like these. Companies, of course, interested in people consuming culture, reading culture, but also interested in people creating and sharing their creativity. We need to have clear examples of these before us, before we think a little bit more about them. I'm going to show you some of them. I'm sure some of them you've all seen. There's an exploding movement of anime music videos out there. Anime, of course, these Japanese cartoons which are spreading across American culture. I don't know about Europe right now, where kids take these cartoons and then re-edit them to set them to music. That's the anime music video. Here are two clips to give you a sense.
I don't want another heartbreak. I don't need another turn to cry. No, I don't want to learn the hard way. Baby, hello. Oh, no. Goodbye. But you got me like a rocket, shooting straight across the sky.
This one may be more familiar. So these are creators. You could call them recreators. Literally tens of thousands of these creators in communities around the web engaging in this recreativity in a non-commercial way, producing and sharing this remix of culture. And of course, it's not just AMVs that are engaging in this use of digital technologies. Context of music, everybody knows or should know this album by the Beatles called The White Album, inspiring this album by Jay-Z called The Black Album, inspiring this album by DJ Danger Mouse called The Gray Album, literally synthesizing the tracks of The White Album and Black Album together to produce something gray. Or in the context of one individual's own life, in 2004, the film Tarnation made its debut at Cannes, said by the BBC to, quote, "Wow, Cannes." This was a film made for $218. Kid took video he'd shot through his whole life, and using an iMac given to him by his friend, he remixed it to produce a film that could wow Cannes and win the 2004 Los Angeles International Film Festival. Or these are some kids who remix trailers in the United States, Chocolate Cake City.
I'm from the future. I came here in a time machine that you invented.
Or maybe most important is the remix in the context of politics. Let me give you three clips. The first from Fox News, which is the conservative right-wing news station in the United States.
Do you ever get the feeling you're living in a virtual reality dream world, fabricated to enslave your mind?
A live all-war edition of American Juniors.
Shake your body.
Push him up.
But there is another sound, the sound of goodwill.
Oh, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I'm far away in a remote place, and we get these things secondhand.
So this one's a little simpler to make.
So to answer your question, I just know how this world works. I see on the TV screens how hard it is. We're making progress. It is hard work. You know, it's hard work. A lot of really good people working hard. They can do the hard work. That's what distinguishes us from the enemy. And it's hard work, but it's necessary work, and that's essential. But again, I want to tell the American people, it's hard work. It is hard work. It's hard work. There was no doubt in my mind that it's necessary work. I understand how hard it is. That's my job. No doubt about it. It's tough. It's hard work, which I really want to do, but I would hope I'd never have to. Nothing wrong with that. But again, I repeat to my fellow citizens, we're making progress. We're making progress there. I reject this notion. It's ludicrous. It is hard work. It's hard work. That's the plan for victory, and that is the best way. What I said was, it's hard work, and made that very clear.
And this is still my favorite.
My love, there's only you in my life, the only thing that's right.
My first love, your every breath that I take, your every step I make.
After politics, what's left but religion? Now, I can't show this in the United States because people get offended easily in the United States, but let's try this here. So this is digital creativity. This is the read-write culture that digital technologies invite. And what's important about this is not the tricks that you've seen, of course, because since the beginning of film, filmmakers, television producers have been able to do everything you've seen right here. What's important is that that capacity has been democratized. That these tools of creativity, because they've been democratized, are now tools of speech. Anybody with a $1,500 computer and access to the free digital network that the internet is has the capacity to remix sounds and images from the culture around us to speak in ways that are meaningful and powerful to the culture we've become. Those of us, academics, who spend our life writing texts, like to believe that writing or words or books is how people understand the world. But the texts, writing, and books, this is the Latin of modern society. A tiny proportion of our world gets access to their world through this medium. Instead, it is video and music and art like that that is the way people understand. And it is the capacity democratized now for that to be a tool of speech, which makes this read-write culture so important. This is a new potential to speak. It's a new potential to learn. It is the literacy of this century, and it is reviving what it means to participate in the creation and spread of culture. Now, these, then, you could say, are two cultures. I want to say that there are really two different minds, the mind of the read-only sort and the mind of the read-write sort. The 20th century is distinguished from the 21st century because that was the century where this read-only conception became central. And the 21st century, like the 19th, 18th, and 17th century, were centuries where the read-only conception was in the background to another conception just as important of creativity. It is a way of thinking about the world. And the difference here is not the difference in whether people are reading or consuming culture other people produce, because read-only and read-write both involve reading. The difference here is the place which democratized writing has in the society. The read-write society encourages this peer production through communities uncontrolled by centralized forces, democratic, in exactly the way that it invites people to create, and in the way it invites people to create so others can read. Now, there are important differences between the read-only and read-write culture. I want to talk about two. One difference, you could say, is the values that each of these two forms of culture embrace. So the read-write culture leaves behind this conception of culture. It leaves behind this passive conception, couch potato conception of culture. It embraces a much more active, engaged, and creative way for people to connect with their culture. And you might say then that this is a much more democratic, socially important, educational set of values associated with this form of culture. But those are a little bit too lefty Berkeley for me. I come from Stanford, so it's not those that I want to talk about as the important values here. I want to instead focus on a really important value here, which is, of course, the value of money. Because the really important difference between the read-only and read-write culture is that the read-only culture is radically small compared to the capacity and economy that the read-write culture would support. You think about the computers and the bandwidth, the devices and software, all of the tools necessary to embed and enable this form of creativity. There is a huge potential for growth in every form of our society, both economic and culturally. This is the potential, the difference between the read-write and a read-only culture. That's one difference. Here's the second. This is the attitude the copyright law brings to the read-only versus the read-write culture. Because copyright law supports the read-only culture. Copyright law supports the legal claims of the read-only culture. The legal claims to say that we have the right to exercise perfect control over how you use culture. That right comes from the peculiar against the background of the history of culture, peculiar architecture of the digital world. For the digital world is a world within which copies are the norm, as familiar as breathing in the physical space. Well, if copyright law regulates copies, then in the digital world, the one thing we know is that every single use of culture, for whatever purpose, technically produces a copy. And so the lawyers look at that and say, well, the presumption is that every single use of culture presumptively requires permission. And in the context of this current debate, this law, this rule, is now supplemented with technology, digital rights management technology, which together work to perfect the power the content owner has to control how people use culture. In this sense, the read-only culture that the internet is producing is radically well supported by the particular architecture of copyright law that we have right now. The read-write internet is different. Copyright law conflicts with the read-write internet. If every use of culture produces a copy, then copyright law regulates every use. Permission is required in each of these contexts, but permission, especially in the context of the United States, is simply not coming. So AMVs are increasingly getting notice and takedown for their work. After I showed this video at a Hollywood event, the very next day he got a notice and he was going to be sued for his particular use of this work. The Beatles, DJ Danger Mouse knew the Beatles never give permission to remix their work. This kid, after he discovered he could wow Khan for $218, then discovered it would cost $400,000 to clear the rights to the music in the background of the video that he shot. And this is my favorite example of the craziness of lawyers. If you want to get a sense of just how weird we can be, I don't care what you think about Tony Blair. I don't care what you think about the war. I don't care what you think about my president, George Bush. Whatever you think about these people and this war, the one thing you can't think about that video is what the lawyers said when they denied permission to synchronize that music to those images. They said, no, you cannot have permission because, quote, it's not funny, end quote. So the point is, we have this law architected in a particular way, architected for a totally different technology, which smothers the capacity of the read-write culture. It rejects the way in which read-write culture would produce and create and share culture. And that rejection increasingly drives policy in the United States. So we have this read-only, read-write culture. Read-only culture, I think, is radically tiny compared to the potential of the read-write culture, yet the law endorses the read-only culture and rejects the read-write culture. What would explain that craziness? Well, a simple answer explaining any craziness is the rhetoric that governs in the United States right now, a rhetoric around war, a rhetoric around the copyright wars, war which my friend Jack Valenti refers to as his own terrorist war, where apparently the terrorists in this war are our kids, right? And this rhetoric, this way of thinking about the problem, drives the push to discover new weapons, weapons of both law and technology, all designed to eliminate something called, quote, piracy. All the while oblivious to the fact that the very same tools deployed to kill piracy will also kill the potential for this read-write culture. The very same locks designed to protect the read-only internet, digital rights management locks, will lock out the potential of this read-write internet. And so the law looks at these two forms of creative potential and picks one and wipes away the other. Now, it's my view we need to find a way to respond to this craziness. And to respond, we have to recognize that the battle here is not just a battle about culture. It's also a battle about how society itself gets organized. And we need to resist in this battle the obsession that comes from the last century to control in every sphere of our life where that control serves no positive purpose. Now, how do we resist? Well, there are lots of particulars. I want to talk about two in this context, ways in which you participate in that resistance. And that's first to help enable free culture And second, to practice free culture, so enabling free culture. There's an extraordinary need in the free culture community to build free tools to enable the production and spread of culture. Free culture needs an operating system which is as important as the operating system that runs our machines, but an operating system which speaks more to the values of our society. This technology designed to support the building of a free culture needs to be built by those who learned the importance of freedom in the context of free software. Technology to enable audio, video, text in cross-platform compatible, open and free protocols that would guarantee the universal ability to spread and build upon culture in the way that the internet has enabled that for applications and data. Now, there are critically important projects out there supporting these new tools of free culture. But I sense that this movement doesn't give enough credibility to these projects. These are not as important as making sure the GNU Linux operating system runs on one more chip platform, right? That's a mistake. We need to enable technically the capacity of free culture by doing three important things. First, organizing consistent opposition to the way this war is being waged right now, which is to deploy DRM inside of the technology that makes free culture possible. We need to fight DRM. Second, to support free protocols, codecs and protocols in general that would encourage the development of neutral cross-platform compatible technology. And third, to support free culture, free software, to make it possible for people to engage in the act of creating and spreading culture easily depending upon only free software. That's the technical job. And then there's a legal job. Legal job to build a platform that enables and protects the freedom that those within the free culture movement view as important. Now, that's obviously part of the objective of the nonprofit I run, Creative Commons. And through the work of millions of licenses around the world, through the work of many who are spreading these licenses around the world, we've begun to have some success in building this into the infrastructure of how people think about free culture. So this is a map of the world as it exists right now. The green countries have launched Creative Commons licenses. The yellow will launch in the next 6 months. The red are yet to be liberated in this process. But as these countries have adopted Creative Commons licenses, the number of licenses that are deployed out there has gone on dramatically. So in the first year, we recorded 1 million link backs to our licenses. A year and a half, that number was at about 1.8 million. At 2 years, the number is at about 4 million. 2.5 years, the number is at 12 million. At 3 years, which was last December, the number is at 45 million. In June, 6 months later, we recorded more than 138 million link backs to these licenses as an extraordinary range of objects and projects begin to adapt this as one way to assert the infrastructure of freedom necessary to build free culture into the society that we are increasingly practicing as a read-write society. So that's to enable. Second is the practice of practicing free culture. Now, this requires you to practice free culture, in my view, everywhere. It's not enough, in my view, to create. You need to create in ways that affirmatively say, we believe in certain values of freedom. And maybe most questionably, I believe we need to build that platform of freedom on both free software platforms and on proprietary platforms. So for example, you know this logo, Flash logo. Flash is, of course, a platform. There are about more than 1 million developers of a Flash platform. In my view, 1 million is way too small. In my view, Flash is a critical tool of digital literacy. It is a critical tool for enabling the read-write culture, especially as kids increasingly find ways to express themselves in this technology. Every single kid should be as familiar with this as they are with writing any text. Now, the question is how to encourage this in a way that supports the values of free culture. And that is to begin to encourage Flash developers to build on the ideas of collaboration that have made free software work to build the read-write culture by teaching them the lesson that has been learned in all of these contexts about why the opportunity to collaborate is so critical, teaching them to share code by making their code free, to signal the freedom on their code, to encourage their source code to be as free as any source code in the free software world is. Now, we're seeing the beginnings of this in the Flash community. Mike Chambers, one of the executives at what was Macromedia, now in Adobe, developed this demonstration of how Flash code could build into it the ability to view the source to the code with one simple click and view the license to the code with one simple click. The idea here is to encourage the infrastructure that enables free software to exist in the context of the software that builds Flash applications. Teaching people that this source is a kind of knowledge and license the source in a way that signals the values behind providing that knowledge, these values of freedom. That is viral for any platform. And my view is it builds support for free platforms, both at the content and the application layer. And the most important example here is the extremely important GNU project of Ganesh, which is seeking to build and has succeeded in important ways so far, a free implementation of this proprietary platform. Now, this builds support that extends and generalizes the support that the free software community has. Some will say, though, to this, and I respect this difference of view, that we should not be building in the context of proprietary platforms. We should be waiting until there are free platforms to build culture with and only build in those contexts where there is that freedom. So, especially in the context of Flash, people oppose the idea of using free culture or free software ideals because the platform itself is not free. Important thing to think about in this context, I believe, when you think about either this version or this version of the GNU Linux operating system, is to remember a very important fact about the history of free software. Was free software built upon free software? The answer, of course, is no, it wasn't. Free software was an ideal that made it possible, after building on non-free software, to create a platform of freedom. And in my view, the movement for freedom here in the culture space is much bigger, much more significant than the movement for freedom in the software space. And if we can tap into the support that that movement would generate everywhere within the society, that would translate into support for the free software that should underlie all of this free culture. Now, in the United States, there's this television commentator, Tom Brokaw, that wrote this book, The Greatest Generation. I want to write a book called The Weirdest Century, because the greatest generation happened in the context of the weirdest century in human history. Century where weirdly powerful, centralizing ideas, weirdly totalitarian conceptions of how society needs to be organized, whether heroes or not, your pick. These are people and ideals and systems that were powerfully controlling over how people participated in their society. Maybe technology made the read-only society necessary. Maybe there was no other way. But the fortune we've inherited with the 21st century is that that century, the 20th century, is over. There's a revival of something different, or maybe a revival as the same as it ever was. The point is, it's a revival of a freer, more creative, more human way of organizing society. That is the read-write society. There is a 20th century mind out there, a mind that can't understand a world where people participate in the creation of all parts of our society. We should celebrate and support its passing. And you, and the work that you've done in the free software movement, have an extraordinarily important role in celebrating and supporting its passing. You need to help teach the rest of society through the practice and experience and what you know about how freedom can be built, that it's possible to build society in every layer of our interaction that depends upon something other than the commands of those at the center. Because you're speaking to a whole generation that does not yet understand how it's possible that freedom can function in each of these extraordinarily important parts of our society. Thank you very much. Thank you. So Volker says I should take questions, and I'd love to take questions, or abuse, whatever you'd like. So,
as a host, I'd like to ask the first question, if I may. And the question is whether you haven't been drawing sort of a black and white picture here.
Yes, all of my slides are black and white, basically. Yeah.
I mean, we didn't plan this. This is pure, pure coincidence, honest. But a bit more serious, this is about the 20th century. And in my opening speech, I tried to rescue some of the honor of the 20th century. And of course, it's also the century of very strong counter-movements. And just to mention a few in the area of media, there were several strong free radio movements, for example. The photocopying machine brought forth a remixing culture, tradition in art. The Situationist in the 1950s devised the first copyleft license for content under which they published their content. And of course, after all, the digital revolution has its roots in the 20th century. So what is there in the 20th century that we can sort of bring over, that we can learn from for the 20th century read-write culture that you described?
Well, of course, only the slides are black and white. The underlying concepts are a continuum. And there are particular aspects of the 20th century that we all would celebrate, and indeed, particular aspects of centralized control that we would celebrate. Certain movements would not have happened if it hadn't been for the power of broadcast technologies that enabled the movements to occur. And we might say that a society where those things aren't possible might in certain respects be less valuable society. But I think there is something to learn about the places where the 21st century peaked into the 20th century. And that's that they are, in my view, all instances of surprises, unplanned events. So the explosion of the internet itself, which I think largely happens because for totally unrelated reasons, the government in the United States forces the telephone companies to allow people to do anything they want to their telephone network and doesn't allow them to discriminate against new uses of the telephone network. That allows people to plug in modems that communicate with computers in a way which, if AT&T could have stopped it, they would have, or would have charged ridiculous rates for it in a way that would have staunched the growth of that particular network. Nobody planned it. Nobody thought about it. But what it architected was an end-to-end network where all of the capacity to innovate was vested at the edge of the network. That is the read-write internet, because the internet's core value of end-to-end guarantees this kind of innovation without the central control. There is a huge struggle in the United States right now about whether the network owners, the people who own the physical layer, will be allowed to exercise control over the applications and content that go on in the network, basically returning us to the pre-internet age. And all of the rhetoric and mentality and policymakers supports the idea of them exercising this control. It's natural to think of these property owners exercising this kind of control. And I think what we've got to learn is where we've seen the kind of explosion of innovation and growth that's been important, it's because we've balanced or limited or engaged in a different ethic of innovation, which is to vest in the broadest, most diverse way the power and the right to innovate.
Okay, thank you. I am the host, but it is my task to give you the chance to ask questions. Can we have a bit more light in the hall, please? And please raise your hands. This young gentleman here will pass out the microphone. Do I see any questions? Yes.
Yeah, my question would be with regard to the interplay between free software and free culture. Richard Stallman has recently come out and said that he can no longer recommend Creative Commons licenses to anybody because he does not like the message that is being that accompanies some of those licenses. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that statement of his and how you think you would like to respond to that.
So obviously, this should be obvious, right? I don't think there was any other event in the history of Creative Commons that was more depressing to me than when I read this decision by Richard. It was a decision that came after many, many months of conversation. Richard's objection to the Creative Commons licenses was an objection based on two licenses, which he thought didn't respect what he believes fundamental freedoms ought to be for all forms of creative expression. So one of those licenses was the sampling license or remix license that allows the creator to say, my derivative rights I give away. You can make derivatives of my work, but the underlying right to control copies of my work I keep. And the second license was a developing nations license that said, people in developing nations are free to do whatever they want with this work, including commercial production of the work. But outside of developing nations, ordinary rules apply. Both of these licenses don't guarantee to everybody the right to make copies. And Richard's view was that that's an essential right for all forms of creativity. Now, my view is very different about how we decide what essential freedoms are. The difference between us is not that his is an idealistic view and mine is a pragmatic view. The difference between us is how we come about deciding or recognizing fundamental values. And as we discussed today in a licensing session, the history of the free software movement was many years of software authors deciding what were the important values for free software. And I believe those important values are expressed by the Free Software Foundation. Of course, I'm on the board, so I have to believe that. But I believe it's the values of free software as expressed in Richard's Four Freedoms and as implemented in the GPL. So in the context of software, I have no disagreement about what the essential freedoms are. But I don't believe anybody is in the position, at least right now, to say what the freedoms are for every form of creative expression. And in my view, what has to happen in each of these other contexts is the same process of deciding what are the important fundamental freedoms for this form of expression. So the sampling license was actually inspired by both Negative Land and Gilberto Gil, culture minister of Brazil. And Gil, you know, is a musician. He is a musician that holds plenty of copyrights, but he is keen as culture minister to push free culture ideals within Brazil. And he says, within the context of music, this is the important freedom, not the ability to take other people's work and just copy it, but the ability to build on their work. And similarly, you could say, what is the importance to an African child of having access to educational materials in the United States? Is it that you can copy those English materials, or is it that you can make derivatives of those English materials, right? Now, the point is, these communities need to decide, like the free software community decided, what the fundamental freedoms are and push for them, fight for them. But I don't think anybody has standing to stand up and say to everybody what their freedoms ought to be. And I, in the position of being just an ignorant lawyer inside of Creative Commons, you know, look to Richard Stallman's view about what the essential freedoms for musicians are, and look to Gilberto Gil's view about what the important essential freedoms for musicians are. And, you know, I have all the respect in the world for Richard, but between those two people, I know who I would defer to in understanding how an economy of creativity functions for musicians. Now, this is more complicated. It's more messy. It requires much more debate and discussion among creators. But that's exactly the hard work that the free culture movement has got to do. Engage creators in every one of these fields in talking about what is important, what is the critical freedom for you. And there can be differences. I don't know enough to say that there are differences. It might be in the end that Richard is right about this, just like he's been right about just about every other point. But we don't short-circuit the process by having a couple of people stand up and say, well, we've built free software, so we now know what free culture is in every sphere of cultural development, or at least That's not the method of Creative Commons. Creative Commons invites communities to decide, and we give them the tools, and we ask them to fight about it, to talk about what is the important freedom, and to push it. But we're not going to dictate, even when it costs the support of Richard Stallman, we're not going to dictate to creators around the world what the essential freedoms are that they must represent. They need to decide that, and we're providing tools and a platform for them to express that. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, I've got a question. In your distinction between a read-only and a read-write culture, is there any implication about how people actually want to participate in a read-write situation? Or the other way, are people willing in a read-write culture to have to participate? Do you want to teach them, or do you want to encourage them, or do you want to force them?
Well, I have a desire to force lots of people to do things, but, you know, would I I force my child, or I will when he's old enough, to learn how to write. And by that, we mean, typically, take words and construct arguments or insights. I also want my child to be forced to make film and to play with music and to figure out how to put images together on a screen to be compelling. Because that also is a kind of writing. It's a writing that the digital age makes available to everybody. And one of the ways to understand this struggle that's occurring right now is that digital media have now democratized media in the way that text was democratized 400 years ago in Western society. Right? So you couldn't control how people write, really. So eventually writing in that very critical democratic way is no longer controlled. And that's what should happen in the context of text. Now, you know, beyond kids, I don't have the desire to force anybody to do anything about this. Indeed, quite the opposite. You know, my view, a lot of people look at this stuff and they say, oh, I hate that, that's crap. Or most of the stuff produced on blogs or these remake stuff is crap. And my view is, that's right, most of it is crap. But the important thing is not whether you believe you're producing better culture. In my view, the important thing is, what right do you have to stop someone from creating? Right? That's the burden copyright law has to bear. It is a restriction on someone's ability to speak. And what we should do is require copyright law, interrogate copyright law, and say, what is your justification for that restriction? Now, I'm of the view that there are cases where there is a justification, a plain justification that supports the ideals of copyright. I'm not opposed to copyright. But I do think that the existing structure of copyright is radically more regulating and expansive than is necessary to support its ideals. And I just think being critical in the name of values of freedom, values of free speech, is the way to force it into its reform. But after it's reformed, and people have the choice to consume or to produce, I think it's their choice. And I don't think anybody should be in the position, at least after they're no longer a kid, to be forced to do one or the other.
We had some very interesting talks recently about remixing, and someone from Canada made a very interesting point that remixing should be a fundamental right for remixing art should be a fundamental right. If the meaning of the artwork is new, then it's a new piece of artwork. If you have a Creative Commons copyright license that specifies that you're allowed to remix, aren't you in fact perhaps undermining that type of argument by now making it, by showing how in fact this can be worked into the copyright law, whereas in fact it shouldn't even need to be written out?
That's right. This is a very important criticism of the whole project of Creative Commons. And the criticism is basically, Neva Elkhorn is I think the best articulator of this criticism. The criticism is basically, when you begin to license these freedoms, don't you reinforce the idea that without the license there wouldn't be these freedoms? Now, I totally agree that's a potential problem. And here's how we fight against it. First of all, the very first thing we say after we define every license is nothing is intended here or can function here to change what are the traditional, what are the freedoms guaranteed by copyright law. In the United States, that's fair use. Other countries, it's fair dealing. So we make it explicit and practice the idea that we're not attempting to modify anything that the law already gives. It's always freedom plus that the license is offering. The second thing is I, in a separate part of my life, actually run a clinic that litigates fair use cases all the time. So this Jesus Will Survive, which the kid's now been threatened with a lawsuit because of his synchronization of this Gloria Gaynor recording. In my view, that right to remix in that is protected by fair use. There's no license necessary for that, right? So we will go to court and defend him for free to justify the practice of that kind of remixing and, you know, the hundreds of thousands of other examples of it that are on YouTube or in Google Video. So you've got to do two things at once. You're going to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time here, right? So one thing is fighting to defend what the law should be giving us. But even if the law gives us a certain amount, there will be something beyond that in the context of remix. That's what the license should be aspiring to. And the other thing, the other way in which it supports it is, if you have lots of content that supports remix, so Gilberto Gil wants to imagine all sorts of Brazilian music supporting the right to remix, you make that form of expression so much a part of the culture that you reinforce the idea that it ought to be an aspect of culture. And the hope is reinforce the idea independent even of this practice of the licensing and encourage more people to participate in it. But, I absolutely agree. This is a risk. And what do you do in the face of a risk like that? Do you sit there and say, well, can't be sure, so we're not going to do anything? Or do you fight to build an infrastructure that tries to advance this freedom in mind, keeping in mind this particular risk? And obviously, we've chosen the second.
Yes, Lawrence, you've mentioned Gil a couple of times in your speech, and you've been to Brazil also and seen things there that we are doing. What, in your view, is or could be or should be the role of governments when we are open to the new forms of creation that you're talking about, that and maybe you can talk about what you've seen in Brazil, and we have a panel tomorrow, and we'll like your testimony about it.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, Claudio, you said, what is the role of, I couldn't hear that word you said.
What is the, what is or what should be or could be the role of government in,
Well, there's two easy cases. First of all, the role of government should not be the role of the United States government has played, which has not been a role to encourage creativity in general, but instead a role captured by a particularly narrow view of what creative industry is, and a role that has now replicated itself in the International Intellectual Property Organization, the WIPO, and increasingly forces its extreme view of intellectual property on countries around the world and most troublingly on developing nations. So that role is absolutely wrong. The second thing that governments can do, I think, is exactly what Brazil is doing. I think Brazil is clearly, around the world, the government that's doing the most to raise awareness and push the practice of free culture and free software into the society of Brazil. Now, as you will say tomorrow, and I'm going to steal your line tonight, but as you'll say tomorrow, the benefit that countries like Brazil have is that they never suffered the 20th century. Right? They never went through the read-only society, really, right? They never had the structures of control that would facilitate it as much. So in a sense, they get to skip from the 19th century to the 21st century, this is exactly Claudio's line I'm stealing, without going through the pathology that a century of this kind of mentality of control produces. And so in that sense, I think there's a greater opportunity in countries like Brazil to demonstrate why this freedom is so important. Now, what is it that it will demonstrate? Well, it's Brazil has encouraged an explosion of a project they call the 1,000 Points of Culture Project, where they build free software labs around the country that are linked on the internet, and also this free software supports free culture on top of it, and they encourage the development and production of this culture around Brazil and the sharing of it around Brazil consistent with these values. And they've developed extraordinary infrastructure to make this kind of collaborative cultural production real in that country, much more real than I think is happening in the United States, or at least in many of the European countries that I've seen. And what that does is change how production of culture is thought of. So I saw this most dramatically just last month when I went to the launch of Creative Commons in Colombia. And in Colombia, there's a musician, Silvia O, who's a famous vocalist in Colombia. And she had contributed some of her music to the CC Mixter site, which is a site that encourages people to remix music, and you can track the genealogy of the music. So you can say, this song is a product of these earlier songs, and this song has been remixed by these later songs. So she's described the experience of watching her music being remixed. And she was speaking in Spanish. The people who remixed it didn't know Spanish. They just cut up the words and did things to it. But it was so creative that it inspired her to layer on her own tracks on top of these other remixes. And then she launched into this really passionate description of how she totally rethinks what it means to be a composer. Before, her whole life, she had been producing music in, as she said, her own studio, which she then broadcasts to the world, and some people listen. But now she thinks of her job as a musician to engage with the community of people who will take her work and do things with it and let her do things to the work that they have done, too. That's the kind of creativity that this infrastructure and this this is in the context of Mixter, this kind of licensing is encouraging. And I think it will change what we really think about in the context of what music, at least, creativity is like. It's a lot like how film developed from the earliest stages of film. When they first developed film, their conception of what you would do to make a movie is to put a camera right in front of a stage and then have a play on the stage. That's what a camera should do. It took a generation of filmmakers before people began to recognize that this technology actually encouraged a different kind of creative production. And I think that's what's happening in Brazil, and I think that's what's going to happen around the world. And I'm confident it's going to happen outside of at least the United States first. And we will be surprised by it in the United States. And the leaders of this kind of vision of culture, I think, will really make many in the United States ashamed of how far behind we have fallen in this ideal of freedom. I can't see anybody out there. Are there lights in this building or no? Okay, there's somebody.
Yeah. Very convincing speech. There was just one point where I thought your argumentation was a bit weak. When you said that read-write would produce more money or make more money available than the read-only, and your arguments on your slide were just hardware, and a computer with DRM has one more piece of hardware, so where does that money come from?
Yeah. Well, I'm so confident about this argument because it's really Yochai's argument, and he's, of course, the smartest guy in the world, so I just believe it's got to be true. The insight here is not just the hardware. It's the hardware, the software, the bandwidth, the activity that goes around this kind of creativity. Because the ability for read-only culture to be distributed using the internet is an ability that can be done relatively efficiently, right? And the read-only, the read-write internet would be a much more expansive kind of network. Think about the difference between photography in its early pre-Kodak stages versus its post-Kodak stages. So the original early versions of photography used something called a daguerreotype, and the daguerreotype's very expensive, cumbersome technology, so only professionals are using doing photography. And then Kodak invents simple, cheap Kodak. Eastman invents the Kodak. And of course, photography just explodes. The market for photography explodes because the number of people in the act of producing images and producing copies so they can share it is radically increased. And the analogy here, I think, is actually quite tight because at the time Kodak is invented, there's a question in at least some of the American courts whether you need permission to capture someone's image. Right? So before you capture their image, do you have to clear rights? And some people thought that was very important because some people believe that you lost your soul if somebody took your picture without your permission. So this is not chicken feed. This was really quite significant. Well, the courts decided, no, you didn't need permission. You could just capture somebody's image. But we could imagine what the market would have looked like if the courts had gone the other way. Right? So you could imagine courts requiring certification of permission. You can imagine something like the Daguerre Machine Control Act, the DMCA, which would have guaranteed that producers of film have certified the permissions. Understand how that structure of regulation could function, not very well, but the guarantee is it would have radically shrunk the market for photography. Of course, it would have been bigger than it was with the daguerreotype, but there would have been more concentration with professionals, less with these amateur photographers. That's the intuition that drives what Yochai's arguing here, because Yochai has this nice comparison of the size of the market, for example, music and films in the United States, and the size of the technology markets that would be supported by telecommunications and computers and software and that kind of infrastructure. And right now, the static size is basically 1 to 10, 10 times larger for the technology industries than the copyright industries. And the growth, then, of that 10 times larger industry, even if it's comparable in rates, would be a growth that is much more valuable to the economy than the growth on the copyright industry. So that's the intuition behind it. We'd love to see why it's not right, but as you talk to as I talk to technologists in Silicon Valley, most of them see their real growth opportunity in this idea of encouraging many more people into the production and sharing of their creativity.
I'd like to ask you two things about the very important point you brought about whether or not one should build free tools layers and free culture on top of proprietary platform. The first one is, wouldn't it be dangerous for if everybody would go to any of the two sides of the arguments, you know? Isn't it a case where, anyway, it's... the value is more in the diversity of the choices than in one of the two. But the second one is maybe more critical, is about, I find that the comparison you did with the bootstrapping time of free software being built on top of proprietary tools is not entirely transportable to the present time, because you could really imagine that today, if you build lots of valuable things on top of a proprietary platform, and I do believe it will be lots of, because I do believe in your argument about this word being much bigger, then in a way you increase the value of a proprietary
yes.
platform, and it can become entrenched in its proprietary character.
Right. So the really bad thing is to imagine a world where lots of people build proprietary culture on top of a proprietary platform, because that reinforces exactly the tendency against freedom that I think we are most concerned about. So I totally agree that if you only were building great creative stuff on top of proprietary platforms and it was all proprietary, that would be terrible, and I wouldn't support the use of either the culture or the applications in that context. But what I think is that we need to take the insight that most of you here have about the importance of freedom in this context and find ways to export it to other creative communities. Right? So when I go talk to filmmakers or musicians, or when I talk to graphic designers about these types of issues, most of them haven't a clue about the conceptions that are central to the debate that goes on in free software. They don't have a clue about why there would be such a thing as fundamental freedoms. They don't have a clue about why it's important to share the infrastructure that enables their creativity to happen. So there's a lot of work to happen. And I think the way to make that work happen is to bring them into the conversation as soon as possible. So that means, rather than going around and telling every Flash developer, stop developing on Flash, you know, use HTML instead or whatever, that's first not going to have much effect on their behavior, and second, will not bring them into the free culture movement. Instead, it will make them feel that they're somehow inferior or bad and they won't listen to much of what we say after that statement at all. Instead, if you say, okay, look, you ought to be producing this in a way that encourages others to be producing, consistent with whatever you're trying to build, and they begin to build the kind of free culture equivalent of free software at their content layer, then they begin to be part of the general movement to freeing society. Now, that, I think, creates the taste for free software at the layer. Now, maybe not necessarily, so you might be right that it doesn't guarantee that, but I look at it and say, between a strategy that says, just ignore the extraordinary proprietary content being made, versus find a way to bring them into the free culture movement, the latter strategy is more likely to move towards platforms that facilitate the kind of open sharing that I think is essential to free culture. Now, the other part, not a popular view in certain circles, but the other part of this is, I'm not somebody who believes that the best strategy is to try to block through force or whatever the development of other platforms and other even proprietary platforms. What I do think is we ought to be working to convince people about the values that are at the center of this movement and to use that persuasion to bring them to this movement. I think one of the biggest weaknesses of especially liberals like me in the United States is that we constantly seek shortcuts to achieving the democratic results that we want. So when I got involved in this movement, the first thing I did was to race to the Supreme Court to try to get the Supreme Court to strike down the Mickey Mouse Protection Act because I thought the Constitution guaranteed this. And I thought, wow, in 3 years we can solve the cornerstone of this ridiculousness and I can go back to my life as an academic. That's ridiculous, right? Because what has to happen is that the ideals of freedom that you guys take for granted, which are totally missed by 98% of the rest of the world, those ideals of freedom have to be spread through persuasion. And persuasion comes by treating somebody else as an equal, by respecting them, by engaging with them on terms of respect, and trying to convince them to your way of seeing the world. That strategy is the reason I push the strategy with respect to proprietary platforms. But again, there's a prediction in it, and I'm not going to say that I'm certain my prediction's right. I just am certain about the ethic that I think is at the core, which is an ethic about how you treat other people. What's the way you engage? Is it a way of engaging of command, or is it a way of engaging of persuasion? And trying to be a citizen of the read-write society, my view is it's got to be a strategy of persuasion.
In the beginning of your talk, you pick up the second point out of a list of 4 points, the free culture. I want to ask you a question about the first point. This was free labor, isn't it?
Yes.
It was free labor. Do you see a similar development on this point, free labor? And doesn't such a development mean, well, a somewhat broader picture? When you talk about read-write society, does this mean on the topic of free labor that we build the operating system of this read-write society?
Yes, I think, in fact, the equivalent of 21st century free labor, the read-write labor, will almost take care of itself here, because there's no strong political opposition to this. And instead, what you have are increasing recognition among economists and people, doing management theory, that the best way to organize your system of production actually is to embrace these ideals of free labor here. So it's an unfortunate title because it makes it sound more political than it is, but Eric von Hippel's book, Democratizing Innovation, is all about companies that are discovering how practicing something more like this free labor idea with their, we don't even have a good word for it, customers, they're not really their customers anymore, they're producers and customers, is a much more efficient way to make money, right? So you don't have to persuade them or you don't have to force them. The one thing business is pretty good at doing is figuring out how to make more money. And so you begin to show them this is the way to make more money and they will build it. That's how they'll do it. So I think that part of the problem would almost take care of itself. Now, the reason I link these together is to just make it clear why there's, you know, what is it that's leading to this change? And again, it's not black and white. There will still be read in read write, but this change, and what leads to this change is really the capacity, the particular capacity of the way this end-to-end network functions. It's because of its architecture that it can invite this kind of creativity in both the labor and the commerce and in the culture and in the politics context. So it is a, you know, you can stamp me as a materialist, or some people would call me Marxist because of this way of thinking about the problem, but it is exactly that. It is you've shift of technology that enables a different, more productive way of connecting. Same thing will happen in the context of politics. We haven't yet seen, maybe the Connecticut primary was an example, but we haven't yet seen a real example of read-write politics winning or working. But the one insight that I think Joe Trippi, who ran the Dean campaign, was right about, is that if you, instead of broadcasting to your base 30-second commercials that tell them what they're supposed to think, if you ask them to participate in the building and spreading of your message, even though the message they will utter is much less refined and much less powerful, and much of it will be stuff you don't even agree with, those people uttering your message in blogs or in other contexts where they are asked to participate become soldiers for your campaign, as opposed to people who are just persuaded to vote for you on election day, right? So the point that Trippi has is that these modes of empowerment that ask the people in the political society to participate in the politics of that society are ways to produce more successful election results. Now, again, I don't think it's happened yet, and I might be wrong, it might not happen. But what I want to point to is the way in which it is exactly the insight that led to the destruction of the last great elite party in the United States, which was our founding party. It's what made the 19th century politics so interesting, politics of people participating. Now technology is enabling, again, it makes it more powerful than broadcast politics. And if that's true, then campaign people will figure that out and they will use it as a means of politics. The one place we have to fight about this, I think, is the place where there are strong vested interests against the change. So there's no strong vested interest in the context of labor or in commerce or maybe in politics, that's yet to be seen. But there is a strong vested interest in the context of culture. And that's because a particular vision of producing culture depends upon the control of the read-only internet. And they are fighting like hell to reinforce it, both through law, but more importantly, through technology. And that's why, you know, I think the GPL3's strong push against DRM at the, not at the necessarily at the content layer, but DRM absolutely at the layer that the software interacts with the hardware is so critical here. Whether it's the right time to do it or not, people will argue about, but the insight that says we have to guarantee that this platform does not become a platform where the controls of law get replicated in the code is a critical insight. And Stallman will get all sorts of criticism for pushing it, including criticism, of course, from Linus here, but I absolutely think that it's a right insight to push to guarantee that freedom at the platform layer. Because if we don't push for that, then they will just, in 5 years, produce the platform that allows them to now exercise the control that won't restrain you, of course, but will restrain 99.999% of the rest of the world, right? And that's the thing that we have to fear most. People listen to me as a lawyer talk about the law and they say, who the hell cares? I mean, people just disobey the law. They don't care what the law says. They just, you know, do whatever the hell they want. But that's only because the architecture invites them to right now. When the architecture makes it extremely hard to disobey the law, when code enforces the law, then again, I'm sure some of you will be great at hacking that architecture. But the great potential of, you know, the ordinary people, and especially institutions like schools or universities, teaching people how to do this, that potential will be lost. So the fight right now is to avoid that control at the code layer. And you know, my anxiety is that we don't have recognition in the society of why it's important to preserve this freedom. That's what the free culture movement is about, and that's why people who've produced it in a software space have to participate in spreading it elsewhere.
Larry, I've got a question for you, yeah. And I really applaud everything that you've said, and I'm there with you with the conclusion. I'm just trying to help you, maybe, if I could say so, to refine the persuasiveness of the argument, because it seems to me to somehow caricaturize the 20th century as a read-only century is actually not the case. The greatest read-write technology, which has had the greatest impact upon the world, was the technology of the 20th century, namely the telephone. And it was the conversation over that infrastructure and that technology, no content. And I just feel, thinking back to my old Harvard professor, Lodge, who said, and I didn't understand it at the time, but I do understand it now a bit better, and that is the emergence of interest group pluralism impacting upon public policy. And it seems to me that this is the first technology, and we were trying to share this afternoon, these digital technologies of abundance, of absurd abundance, of fiber, the silicon chip, and smart wireless, these are the first technologies that have sort of been crafted into reality through government policy, attempting to have a nice migratory path to the future. And of course, the people that government listen to are the strong, powerful, vested interests. Sure. They don't listen to all the creative geniuses that won't exist unless the technology gets out into the hands of the people. But it seems to me that to categorize it or to can this read-write and read-only into a time thing is maybe not
well, accurate. I appreciate the suggestion. I spend so much time trying to figure out how to tell these stories in ways that tries to persuade, and I'm sometimes surprised by how people are sensitivities people have. I've you're not the first person who's really strongly defended the 20th century, and I never knew it had such important reasons to be defended. So maybe, maybe we just have to be, I have to be nicer to the 20th century. But I actually do think there is a difference here. I don't think the telephone is read-write culture. I mean, the telephone is communication. That's important. But what makes read-write important is the same thing that makes writing important. It is that my creativity can be shared with others. So I write something, and it's not that, one person can see it. It's that I can make it as accessible to thousands of people. And of course, that's exactly what digital technologies have done with writing and what they could do with these other forms of media. That's what I think is critical, because you could recognize all through the history of society, in some sense, people have been participating in read-write. Like, you go watch a movie by Michael Moore, Fahrenheit 9/11, you tell your friends that's the best movie ever made or the worst movie ever made, and you then recount it to your friends. You, in a sense, are rewriting what Moore did. That's certainly the same kind of remix that I'm talking about. But the significance here is now I can share it. And the power of sharing it is what makes this so distinct. So that's one important difference. The second is, the more I think about it, the more I talk to people about this, I just think there is this attitude difference. People who look at, even among people I think of as heroes. So my favorite example of this recently is Al Gore. Whom, it's not a popular view, but I'd give my right arm to make him president of the United States. I'm left-handed, but I'd give my right arm. Okay, so Al Gore has this film, Inconvenient Truth, but more important than the film, he has this slideshow that he's been going around presenting. It is by far the best rhetorical performance of any argument I've ever seen in any subject at all, by far. It is unbelievably powerful in its persuasive force about the danger of global warming. So, we had a conversation with Gore about how we can make this message something more than just the third largest documentary film in the history of documentary films, make it into something that actually changes how people think. And I think to the 21st century person, the person who experiences Wikipedia and all these other things, the intuition is clear. Like you say to Gore, which we said, release the slides. Put the slides out there and say to everybody, you make your own version, or you remix it, or you change it, or you criticize it, or you do whatever you want with it. But what you do is take what I've done and do something with it. Gore, who of course is devoting his life now to this, absolutely recoils from this idea. His view is, oh my God, I spend so much time getting the message exactly right. And if I put it out there, who's to say anybody else will get the message as right as I do, right? Now, true. Nobody will do it as well as Gore. I'm sure of that. I've seen a lot of awful speeches and a lot of good speeches, and nothing comes close to the potential he has here. But it misses the point. It just sees the issue in a way that I think reflects this idea that the most important thing to do, which is the 20th century mind, is to find a way to speak powerfully and clearly and strongly to people and to let them sit there, you know, the way we've organized this talk, you know, sit there, where you sit there and listen. This is what's important. And that has a certain kind of effect, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but that's the effect. That wasn't the telephone, I agree. Now, I'm not saying the telephone was read-only, but I'm saying I don't think it has that version of read-write. But that mentality is, I think, the mentality we're eroding in the 21st century. Like it's natural for a lot of us to think about how you make something persuasive, which is not about exercising obsessive control over it. It's about setting it free and, you know, letting other people do things with it. Now, it's just an observation. Maybe it's wrong, but I do think that there's something about the way culture, at least in the United States, was produced that makes it seem natural that we have this professionalized, centralized form of culture, and the 21st century challenges that. That's the only claim. More? Anybody? People out there? Yes. Right here.
Hi. You speak repeatedly about the need to convince people or to spread the message and the importance of language in that. And I think you touched earlier on the need to move away from rhetoric, their rhetoric specifically. And you cited piracy, I think, as an example. But I keep hearing here two words over and over again, which in my mind are very destructive kind of rhetoric terms. One is the idea of copyright protection, which infers a real and imminent kind of physical danger to the copyright itself that needs to be protected from something. I can't think of an example of a copyright holder experiencing that, but I can think of a lot of examples of violators actually having their lives ruined. And the other is the notion of derivative works as opposed to transformative works, which infers that the value is actually still held in the source material rather than in the new work. I just wondered what your comments.
Yeah, those are fair points. Both of them come just from particularly boring context in which I get educated about these. So this is the normal way the law talks about these ideas. And you're right. You have to have a rhetoric that actually evokes the kind of values that are important here. And Richard's made this point a lot about the words copyright protection in particular. And the same thing about derivative works. I guess I always love the derivative. I love derivative. I mean, I think this is like the best thing. So it's hard for me to connect to why this sounds like it's a derogatory word. What better than to be derivative? But maybe you're right, and something I should think about.
I have a question. You discussed about the two tools the Hollywood complex uses, which are legal tools and technical tools. But don't you think that they use also a propaganda tool? And shouldn't we centralize a counter-propaganda tool in the process?
Yeah. So, of course, they use propaganda tools. They talk about creative property, and to the ordinary person, that sounds like ordinary property. And so the ordinary person thinks, well, why is it that creative property should be protected any less, again, there's that word, but protected any less forcefully than ordinary property? Like, nobody has a fair use right to my car. Why should anybody have a fair use right to my music? I get to own my car. I have the right to own my car for 100 years, of course. And they have the right to their, why should they have any less right with respect to their copyrights? The problem is, in fact, the other side, Valenti at the center of this, has been so successful in making that way of talking normal that it actually takes insight to recognize it as propaganda. That's just normal way of talking about it. And the other side, you know, that our side, or at least my side in it, that would try to centralize and control the propaganda, the quote, counter-propaganda, would be seen as just evoking propaganda. So even though framers of my Constitution would have thought of copyrights as monopolies and spoke of them as monopolies, when you go around talking about them as monopolies, it just doesn't connect as powerfully as if you find other ways to advance it. So it would be good if we could deploy propaganda as effectively as they do, meaning without it being recognized as propaganda. But it's part of the problem of fighting against such a well-established view of the role of property here that it's very hard to do that. I wish we could.
Hello, right here. If I understand correctly, it's the reader-only industry that is, well, trying to hold the read-write society. And wouldn't the most convincing, well, argument be if we could somehow give that read-only industry, well, an argument that they should switch now, that if that they won't succeed anyway, and this has kind of happened with Netscape and IBM, they've started investing in Linux or made their source open, and on that, shouldn't we be giving them arguments in other areas like the music industry or for these remixes, for example, that they can actually make quite a lot of money if they switch now? Otherwise, they'll go off the market.
Yes, we should. But more than that, what's stopping these other industries is, or slowing them down, is that their business model is rendered illegal by regulations that say that, you know, if you're encouraging copyright infringement, you yourself can be an infringer. And the technology, the infrastructure of technology that's being pushed in DRM, both through broadcast flag-like provisions and also just in the deals being struck with companies providing infrastructure, make these ways of doing business much harder. So, the content industry in the United States, at least, has been very good at making companies supporting technology themselves seem like pirates, right? They quote pirates. They frame them in a way that makes it seem like they don't respect IP in the broadest sense. And that's very embarrassing for them because all of these companies pushing these technologies, like Intel and companies like that, of course, have their own particular form of protection, like patents and copyrights that they want to support, and it's very hard for them to defend the alternative in this climate where every exercise of freedom is seen to be a violation of property rights. So again, if we didn't have the law in the middle of this battle, the law in the form of regulations supporting DRM, regulations blocking these other forms of business, I would have a lot of faith in the businesses to find the better market. But it's always the case that the most powerful interests, when threatened by new competition, turn first to the government to protect them. And that's exactly what's happened here. The new competition and this new way of producing sharing content is fought against by people using the government to fight. Now, in some sense, I think we've helped that, helped them in that battle, because so much of our early work, you know, and I'm on the board of the EFF, and so I bear responsibility for this too. But so much of the work in fighting in this context was work fighting to defend, for example, technologies like peer-to-peer file sharing technologies. Now, I think that technology absolutely should be defended, and I think it should be defended for what turns out to be a relatively esoteric legal reason about keeping courts out of the business of judging the legality of technologies. But I think one consequence of focusing so much attention on peer-to-peer file sharing was that the message of the free culture, free software movement gets lost, because 90% of people, when they hear about peer-to-peer file sharing, think that this is just a technology to enable people to, quote, steal. Of course, they like it because it helps them steal too, but they don't feel like they can really justify it. As opposed to lots of other cases of extremism in IP, where I think 90% of the people, if they heard them or understood them, would be on our side naturally. I mean, my favorite recent example is a case that was decided in New York by the highest court of New York last April 2005. There's a company called Naxos, which produces restorations of public domain recordings. They had restored a public domain recording, public domain in England, a classical recording, and released it on this remastered version on the internet. I mean, released it to be sold all across the internet, but sold in regular CD form. The company that was the successor in interest to the company that made the recordings in England came to the New York courts and filed a lawsuit against Naxos, and said, even though your recordings were in the public domain in England, they're not in the public domain in New York. And that's because, this company argued, New York common law protects copyrights in recordings perpetually, regardless of where they're made, regardless of when they're made. They're protected by copyright perpetually. The New York Court of Appeals on April 5th, 2005, agreed with that argument and issued an opinion that said these are protected perpetually, or at least until federal law intervenes, and that will happen in 2067. What that decision means is that every single recording ever made in the history of man is protected by New York law until 2067, which means if you want to set up an archive of old recordings, you can't make it accessible, at least in New York, without risking some liability, because you need to clear rights to make that archive accessible, and you need to clear rights from the property owner. And who is the property owner, right? What percentage of recordings ever made in the history of man could you identify the property owner for? You know, maybe 0.001%. So the point is, here's a story where it's everybody, when they hear this story, thinks this is ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. But it's the plain consequence of the kind of extremism which governs this debate. And if we focus people more on these extremism, this kind of extremism, I think we would have a much stronger support in the general public for why there needs to be some reform here. Obviously not among groups like this, where, you know, I think the sophistication to understand why peer-to-peer is important exists. That sophistication doesn't exist everywhere.
Hi. I was really struck by your characterization of pre-20th century culture as a read-write culture, because when you said, you know, pre-20th century culture, the first thing that springs to mind for me is traditional music, folk music. And I'm an Irish traditional fiddle player myself. And it, you know, when I think about it, the folk process, as it has been traditionally described, has a lot of very interesting analogies. Yes. With the development, even you could say, of software. And the, there's each musician will take a tune, learn it directly from another person, but no one can play a tune exactly the way that another plays it, and so it morphs slightly, and then someone will slightly misremember a tune, and then it forks, so to speak, you know, branches off, and you'll find multiple different versions. And that's actually one of the great and wonderful things about traditional music, the whole variety, that the fact that it isn't standardized and centralized, except for Scottish fiddle. But anyway, so I was wondering if you had ever come across any sort of comparisons between free content and free culture and the processes used to create them, and the folk process in music?
Well, the point about folk music is a great one, and it's a point that Negative Land makes all the time. If the rules of copyright as they exist right now had existed during the major periods of folk music, it couldn't have happened. It just would have been illegal. The other really great example of this that I saw was when we launched Creative Commons in Slovenia. A fantastic classical composer who was Slovenian, but he lived in the United States, but he came over to perform, he and his now wife perform a composition, which he wants to be able to release under Creative Commons license. And he described to the audience what classical composition was, which was a process of integrating the music of the time with your own music, constantly synthesizing in that exact way. And he describes how classical music today, or classical music produced today, can't do that, because you can't incorporate in that way music unless it's out of copyright. And of course, it won't be out of copyright for at least 75 years for older music, and life of the author plus 70 for new music. And so the rule changes the kind of creative work that you can produce. He wants to push, and I think this is a great example of why the remix license is so great, a kind of norm among classical composers, where they just give away their derivative or their transformative rights automatically. And so what they say is, this is my composition, so when you produce my composition or whatever, you pay me the ordinary stuff, but I want to encourage the culture that allowed people to build upon classical music in the way it was before. And you know, that for me was a compelling argument by an artist about what it means to be a certain kind of artist. And that's exactly the argument that we need to encourage. Because I find is that you talk to each of these different artistic communities, there's this moment of recognition, just like you demonstrated, where they see the connection, and they see what's wrong with the existing system, and they begin to be, you know, soldiers on the side of changing it. And you know, as powerful and influential as the free software world is, you really do, really, really do need the support of every other kind of creator for this change to have any effect. And I think that's exactly what this sort of spreading of the idea has to be about.
I think with this bracket between the pre-20th century and the 21st century, we're at a very good point to end the discussion here. It's, of course, a very rich talk that created a lot of discussion. And, of course, we can go on. Larry Lessig just moved to Berlin, so he will be staying at the American Academy for a full year. This is for sort of a retreat, writing your next book, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, those of us who are in Berlin, I'm sure, will have more opportunities during that year to continue discussion. In the beginning, I announced that there will be another announcement to make, and I'm very happy that the publisher of the German version of Larry's book, Free Culture, the Open Source Press, is today releasing this German version under a Creative Commons license, under the attribution non-commercial license. So remixing is explicitly allowed. The text is available at the URL opensourcepress, all one word, .de, freie_kultur/freie_kultur. I heard that they're going to improve that URL a bit. The next thing that will happen is, in fact, a signing session. Right outside here, when you go into the central area, just outside the door, underneath the light, there will be a chance to get books signed by Larry. And then after that, there will be the launch party of Registered Commons. And of course, the German version of Free Culture will be one of the first works to be registered, together with the world debut that will be performed there of the Tuxedo Blues, that will also be registered in Registered Commons. And the Registered Commons project is inviting you for free beer, so please pick up a cup at the entrance. And after that, there will be the Netlabel parties. So thank you all for the great discussion, for your attention, and please give a big hand to Larry Lessig.
Thank you.